Prosecutors in Pennsylvania are looking into possible environmental crimes committed during the fracking boom.
As soon as our prosecutors and investigators started digging into this, they said, yes, there are significant problems. Yes, some of them could fall into criminal charges.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the potential legal jeopardy for oil and gas companies in Pennsylvania. Plus, new technology could turn problematic plastic bags into other stuff, like backyard decks. Or could it?
It's a good idea, but sometimes a good idea may turn out not to be so ideal at the end.
And Pennsylvania commits to goals outlined in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement.
We know why our planet is becoming warmer, and we know we need to change course before it's too late.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Two environmental groups have sued U.S. Steel for allegedly violating the Federal Clean Air Act after a December 24th fire at the company's Clairton Coke Works. Under its air quality permit, the plant is required to clean up its coke oven gas, a byproduct of producing coke, through a set of pollution controls. But the Christmas Eve fire knocked the plant's pollution controls offline. That caused the plant to release higher levels of pollution, exposing residents to short and long-term health impacts, the suit alleges. Ashley Deemer of the group Penn Environment says the company should have had a backup plan to clean up its coke oven gas in the event of a pollution control outage.
We know that pollution controls have come offline before. There are malfunctions at the plant from time to time, and there should be a way to reroute that coke oven gas to another pollution control so that this never happens.
A spokeswoman for U.S. Steel says the company is reviewing the complaint. On Thursday, the company announced it will spend $1 billion on upgrades to its Mon Valley Works, which includes Clairton Coke Works, Edgar Thompson Steelworks in Braddock, and the Irvin plant in West Mifflin. It says a combined casting and rolling facility and a cogeneration power plant will increase efficiency and reduce emissions. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency last week said it will not strengthen regulations on waste created by oil and gas production. As Brittany Patterson reports, that could affect communities across the Ohio Valley, where the oil and gas industry is booming.
EPA announced last week it will not craft any new regulations about the disposal of oil and gas drilling byproducts. Millions of tons of brine or salty water laced with chemicals, metals, and radioactivity, as well as similarly contaminated sludge, rock, and mud, are created each year when wells are fracked. In its decision, the agency said states have adequate regulations in place, but they acknowledged state rules often vary. Advocates say EPA rules would create a baseline for how millions of tons of liquid and solid waste should be disposed. Aaron Minces is with the environmental nonprofit group Earthworks.
The Trump administration has hung out to dry communities that host oil and gas development.
EPA rules would also prevent companies from shopping around for places to dispose fracking waste, sometimes illegally. That's what happened in Estill County, Kentucky. About 4 years ago, tons of low-level radioactive waste were illegally dumped in a landfill across from a school. Residents there are still fighting with the state on how best to deal with that waste. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Pennsylvania is the latest state to debate whether to provide a rescue package to its nuclear power industry. Two bills are under consideration in the State House and Senate. But as State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports, the state's unique history and current energy landscape make subsidies a tougher sell here.
Other states, including New Jersey, New York, Illinois, and Connecticut, have recently approved billions of dollars in subsidies to keep their nuclear plants open. But Pennsylvania's different. It's got a powerful natural gas industry that's in direct competition with nuclear plants, and it has the legacy of Three Mile Island. The partial meltdown caused tens of thousands of people to evacuate central Pennsylvania in 1979. Representative Donna Bullock, a Philadelphia Democrat, says she's still undecided on the bailout bill. Both the House and Senate measures would cost the state's electric customers about $500 million annually.
That's a little hard for me to swallow. to spend this amount of money and not have any advances when it comes to cleaner energy, not have any advances when it comes to more affordable energy.
Exelon, which owns Three Mile Island's Unit 1 reactor, says the state needs to pass legislation by June 1st, or it will move ahead with its plans to retire the plant early in September. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Last year's report by the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, was an eye-opener. It basically said the world has 12 years to keep global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avoid catastrophic drought and storms. In Pennsylvania, 2018 was the wettest year to date.
And we know why our storms are becoming more frequent and more intense. We know why our planet is becoming warmer. And we know we need to change course before it's too late.
To change course, and in direct opposition to the Trump administration, Governor Tom Wolf just announced that Pennsylvania will join two dozen states committed to goals outlined in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. Governor Wolf announced the move at an event to release the state's latest climate action plan. And State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips is here to fill us in. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Kara.
Pennsylvania is the 24th state to join the U.S. Climate Alliance, which is a bipartisan group of two dozen states committed to the goals that were outlined in the 2015 UN Paris Climate Agreement. Is Pennsylvania kind of late to the game here?
I guess in some sense you could say yes, but Pennsylvania is a lot different than the other states in that Pennsylvania actually produces a lot of electricity compared to the others who don't. And Wolf even acknowledged this when he made this statement, that the state does produce a lot of electricity. Much of it, of course, you know, increasingly with natural gas and also with coal. You know, it makes Pennsylvania the one that really has to go the extra mile to cut their carbon emissions, and given the fact that they produce so much carbon emissions due to the state producing so much electricity for not just Pennsylvania residents, but residents all across the country.
So in essence, it's harder for Pennsylvania to create a climate action plan like this.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, and a lot of other states, of course, have gone a lot farther than Pennsylvania. I mean, you see other states, you know, already doing cap and trade. And Pennsylvania, as you know, has not joined REGI, which is the regional cap and trade program that includes states from the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. You know, it's a regulatory program that limits or caps the total amount of emissions that can be released into the atmosphere. Pennsylvania is pretty much the only one that's not joined REGI. Wolf has already said that it would kind of put them in a difficult position anyway because they do produce so much electricity. Now, the Environmental Quality Board right now is looking at a plan that was primarily produced by the Clean Air Council for Pennsylvania to create its own cap and trade program. Basically they ruled that DEP has to look at this and make a decision about it. So that'll be interesting to see what comes of that effort.
So this latest climate action plan outlines 100 actions to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050. And those cuts are based on 2005 emission levels. What are some of the actions that are mentioned? I know some of them are what they call more effective.
Yeah, it runs the gamut. They're pushing for these 15 actions that they say will cut emissions 21% by 2025 and 36% by 2050. Of course, that falls far short of their goal. But there are things, you know, that would promote energy-efficient buildings, you know, electric vehicles, greater renewable energy production. I mean, he also put his weight behind a bill that they're calling 30 by 30, which is they would change the current alternative energy portfolio standards, meaning the amount of electricity that producers are required to produce right now has to be 8%, what they would consider renewable or clean. But they want to bump that up to 30% by 2030. and 10% of that 30% would have to be solar. So that's one of the big things. But again, it's, you know, that would require legislative approval. It's unclear whether that would actually happen given, you know, state of things in Harrisburg, where you have Republicans that are pretty hostile, many of them even to climate change itself. I mean, they've been holding these hearings where they have climate deniers testifying.
Right. Well, how does this plan tie into the fight that's happening right now in the Pennsylvania legislature over bailing out the state's nuclear power plants, which are being touted as carbon-free electricity?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And at the press conference that Wolf had, he's been very noncommittal when it comes to whether he supports the details of the current nuclear bailout as it is proposed. The plan itself, in order to get to these goals, assumes that we're going to be producing the same amount of nuclear energy in 2025 and 2050 as we are today, which one would assume means that, you know, some kind of bailout would have to happen. But it's interesting because lawmakers from Philadelphia, of course, are pushing for the fact that if they're going to have a nuclear bailout, they want to use that as leverage to also increase other forms of renewable energy production like wind and solar.
Okay, so we have increased renewables, energy efficiency. I think there's some mention of emissions reductions by using electric vehicles. Is there anything unusual in the plan or something that we haven't seen before?
Well, the important thing to note is that this draft report came out in November. So there was nothing significantly different between November and, you know, this week that I could see anyway. You know, he acknowledged that Pennsylvania is a fossil fuel state. You know, a lot of people would say at this point, given the recent IPCC report, you know, we really got to be a little bit bolder and really push for greater reductions and get us off, you know, the carbon energy wheel and get more onto the renewables. It doesn't do that. It does acknowledge that methane leaks from natural gas production is a pretty damaging greenhouse gas. And so it talks about limiting the leaks from natural gas production. I think a lot of people are happy that Wolf came out with this in the environmental community, but I think they're sort of like walking this fine line between, you know, happy that they have a Democratic governor that's doing something, but also feeling at the same time that really, at the end of the day, it's not enough at this point, that the actions that happen have to be a little bit bolder. And also at the end of the day, I think they're, you know, worried that the proof is in the pudding. Like, what kind of action will actually take place?
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
Susan Phillips is with State Impact Pennsylvania, and you can learn more about Pennsylvania's climate plan at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. It takes dedication to do the work to keep a river clean, time to understand the problems, and the capacity to come up with solutions. And it takes something else.
I love this river. Totally love this river.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, more about an ecologist and river lover. Stay tuned. For years, residents in Pennsylvania living near fracking sites, pipelines, and other oil and gas infrastructure have complained about impacts like pollution. Now, prosecutors on both sides of the state have launched criminal probes into the state's fracking boom. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier looks ahead to where these investigations might go.
When he ran for attorney general in 2016, Josh Shapiro promised to prosecute the state's fracking industry. In this campaign ad, he said regulators were being too soft on polluters.
All they've ever gotten is just a slap on the wrist. It's time for that to change. I'm Josh Shapiro, and I'll hold the oil and gas companies criminally liable for poisoning our air and our drinking water. I'll be an attorney general who always works for you.
Democrat Josh Shapiro appears to be living up to this promise. He's summoned witnesses before an investigative grand jury in Pittsburgh to look into possible environmental crimes related to oil and gas activities. Close to Philadelphia, he's helping Delaware County prosecutors investigate the troubled Mariner East pipeline, which has caused sinkholes, contaminated well water, and leaked gasoline into waterways. Meanwhile, Chester County District Attorney Tom Hogan has launched a grand jury investigation of his own on the Mariner East. Here he is in January talking about his decision to investigate the pipeline.
Somebody's got to step in. Our citizens are very concerned. And as soon as our prosecutors and investigators started digging into this, they said, yes, there are significant problems. Yes, some of them could fall into criminal charges.
A spokeswoman for Energy Transfer, the company behind the Mariner East, declined to be interviewed. But in a statement, she said there was no, quote, legitimate basis for an investigation, and that the company would aggressively defend itself. Penalties for environmental crimes can include fines, probation, even jail time. Typically, these prosecutions involve proving the intent or mental state of an individual or corporation, says David Ullman, a former environmental crimes prosecutor for the U.S. Department of Justice. Ullman, who's now a law professor at Michigan, says companies can't plead ignorance of the laws they're accused of breaking.
You know, ignorance of the law generally is not a defense in the United States. And it's not the case that companies can say, oh, well, I had no idea that the law applied to my conduct, or I didn't realize what the law required.
Prosecutors have a high bar, proving a case beyond a reasonable doubt. But they also have tools that other government agents don't. These include the ability to convene a grand jury, says Mark Fried, a former prosecutor in the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office.
They have the power to subpoena, so they are very useful in conducting investigations, gathering the evidence that's needed then for the prosecuting agency to then decide they have enough information to make a charge.
Having subpoena power means prosecutors can talk to people who've signed non-disclosure agreements with oil and gas companies. Shapiro and his deputies have used this to talk with Stephanie Halowich, a Western Pennsylvania woman who testified before the grand jury in Pittsburgh in February. In a lawsuit she settled in 2012, Halowich claimed Range Resources and two other oil and gas companies contaminated the air and water at her Washington County home. A letter from Shapiro to attorneys in another civil case involving Range asked they preserve documents and evidence. So is Range a target of the investigation? That's tough to say, says Jamie Colburn, a former EPA attorney who's now a Penn State law professor.
You don't open a grand jury investigation because you know who's guilty. You open a grand jury investigation to find out if anybody is guilty.
Spokesman for Range Resources didn't respond to multiple requests for comment. The Attorney General's office won't even confirm there is an investigation, let alone discuss details of the case. Before it was settled, Halowich's lawsuit also named the state's Department of Environmental Protection as a defendant. In other high-profile contamination cases, public agencies tasked with safeguarding water supplies have become targets for prosecution. In Michigan, the state attorney general has charged 15 officials for their roles in the Flint water crisis, and three have pled guilty. Shapiro himself charged Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority with more than 150 counts related to lead in Pittsburgh's drinking water. So far, there's been no indication that Shapiro is investigating DEP's role in regulating oil and gas companies. Chris Carasone, a former chief deputy attorney general in Pennsylvania, says he wouldn't bet on that happening.
Yeah, I think that would be highly unlikely. I can't imagine a scenario where the attorney general's office could investigate the DEP for failing to do its job.
He says typically environmental crimes are reserved for individuals or companies, not government agencies.
You could have a scenario where a state employee is charged with conspiring with a business entity or other individuals outside of the agency to violate the law.
Ullman, the former Department of Justice lawyer, says prosecutors can only enforce laws already on the books. He said criminal investigations are no substitute for regulation of industry by legislatures and state agencies.
You can't go in through the back door and sort of regulate through litigation conduct that you haven't regulated at the front end, or at least you can't do that in the criminal law.
One possibility most agree on, prosecutors could go through all this and decide they don't have enough evidence to bring charges. Grand juries in Pennsylvania can last up to 24 months. When they're done, they can release their findings in a report. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Those plastic bags you get at the grocery store, well, you know you're not supposed to put them in the recycling bin because they can create a huge headache for the recycling industry and the environment. But now recyclers are experimenting with technologies to find a second life for plastic bags and other flexible plastic packaging. WHYY's Dana Bate has more.
I'm standing inside a recycling plant near Reading, Pennsylvania, looking down on a mountain of cardboard boxes, plastic bottles, and glass jars. A front loader pushes, lifts, and dumps just some of the 500 to 600 tons of waste the plant processes every day. I'm here to spot stuff that traditionally is not supposed to be here.
Your Go-Gurt packs, your applesauce containers, the inside liner of your cereal box, your Purina dog food bags, chip bags, snack bags, Snickers wrappers.
That's TJ Stinson, recycling coordinator at JP Mascaro & Sons. The stuff he's talking about is called flexible plastic packaging and also includes things like plastic shopping bags and shrink wrap.
I can see the bags and the plastic in there already. Like, there's tons of it already.
Absolutely, and it's already going to be a part of the mixture there. We estimate it to be 1% of our total intake now, and that number will only go up.
1% of 500 means at least 5 tons of plastic packaging that until recently, the company wasn't set up to handle. Plastic bags and other flexible plastics get stuck in sorting equipment and can grind the works to a halt. And they can't be processed with thicker plastics like water bottles. JP Mascaro is trying to change that. They've launched a pilot project to recycle this flexible plastic instead of sending it to the landfill. The new sorting equipment blows the lightweight plastic to separate it from things like paper and thicker plastics, and eventually it's suctioned up through a vacuum onto a conveyor belt. Later, it's packed with similar material into a bale. Right now, all of this stuff has gotten here mistakenly. The company isn't ready for people to start putting these products in their recycling bins. JP Mascaro just wants to test its new sorting equipment to make sure it works, and it's shopping around to see who could turn all of this flexible packaging into something useful.
What we are trying to do is get all of the packaging material that currently goes in the landfill, get it into our building, accumulate it, and find a new market that we can put it back to use, give it a second life.
It's still unclear what that second life will be. The best uses so far include products like corrugated pipes or decking materials like the brand Trex. There's a challenge in imagining next-generation products made from these flexible plastics. They contain impurities, so they can't be used for medical products or anything involving food. That brings us back to decking and other building materials, or maybe a fuel like biodiesel. But Grace Swan, an environmental engineer at Drexel University, says some of those options could be very expensive and use more energy than is being saved by recycling this stuff.
It's a good idea, but sometimes a good idea may turn out not to be so ideal at the end because the process is so complicated and so energy demanding.
That hasn't dissuaded environmental management specialist Susan Graff, who is spearheading the research that led to the pilot project back in Reading. She says these hard-to-recycle plastics are a reality of modern life.
It's everywhere. Let's not set up to landfill it. Let's do the science.
The science to turn these plastics into something useful. The researchers and the recycling plant are getting a lot of funding from companies that put these plastics into the world. Procter & Gamble, Pepsi, Target. Firms that might be motivated to respond to anti-plastic sentiment and the laws that have followed.
I think it's a model of how you do research and our brands work with the recycling industry to not push something on them, but to solve the problem with them.
J.P. Mascaro, the recycling company, hopes to test the program in two communities, Birdsboro and Pottstown, this summer.
We assume that there's going to be some hiccups, some snags. We might have to change this a little bit as we find out what works and doesn't work.
Eventually, the company wants to collect from the other 100 municipalities it serves in the Philly suburbs. I'm Dana Bate in Philadelphia.
Occasionally, we turn our attention not just to the air quality, water, and wildlife in our region, but to the people who are working to protect them, and to what inspires their dedication. And so today, we have this postcard from Susan Phillips in Philadelphia.
If you want to study major urban river systems and tidal estuaries or anything like that, there's no better laboratory in the United States than this system right here. But it's so underappreciated. Hi, I'm Danielle Krieger. I am a scientist with the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary and also research faculty at Drexel University. My interest in aquatic ecology and marine biology really goes back to my childhood. I was very lucky that I had a grandmother who lived in Ocean City, Maryland. So spending my summers at the shoreline in the water, surfing or fishing in the water, I saw marine life. I got very interested in marine biology because of my connection to the shore growing up. Very few people in Philadelphia in this area know that this is a treasure. This system has plants and animals that you do not have in any abundance in these other major estuaries like Chesapeake Bay. You know, it's this wonderful treasure and everybody understands it's a national treasure. Totally, I get that. Why not the Delaware River? This river, the Delaware River, is the longest undammed river east of the Mississippi. We have some wonderful treasures here. The freshwater mussel beds that we discovered between Trenton and Philly, we found species that were believed extinct, living in abundance. I love this river. Totally love this river.
Danielle Krieger is an ecologist and senior science director at the Partnership for the Delaware Estuary. And as you heard, one of her specialties is mussels. Freshwater mussels once lined the banks of rivers, streams, and lakes in Pennsylvania. But now mussels are some of the most endangered species of animal. A new project will help restore these former mussel beds as a way to clean up waterways. The Pennsylvania Infrastructure Task Force, or PennVest, has given $7.9 million for a new mussel hatchery in southwest Philadelphia. The Partnership for the Delaware Estuary will build the hatchery. Danielle Krieger says 95% of the regional streams she surveyed no longer have any mussel beds.
And by losing that natural filter system in our river, that makes it much harder for us to keep the water clean.
Mussels consume microscopic particles that make water muddy, including algae, silt, and clay. The adult mussel colonies will be placed in both the Delaware and Susquehanna watersheds. For more stories about wildlife projects, head to our website, AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and our podcast, Trump on Earth. Those episodes are at trumponearth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schuman Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.